7, a session of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. And today we're going to be having a public hearing on House Bill 2095. And we have some, Ellen, would you first please give us a review of the bill?
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 2095 does several things. It allows the housing authorities to finance, develop, own, or operate a mixed-income housing project under certain conditions. It also allows housing authorities to form, finance, have a non-stock interest in, and operate partnerships, nonprofit corporations, and limited liability companies. It replaces the annual report requirement that housing authorities currently have with an annual independent audit requirement. It changes the means for proving a proper appointment of a housing authority commissioner, and it changes existing definitions and adds new definitions.
Thank you very much. And from the Oregon Housing and Community Services, we have John Fletcher.
Actually, Bob Gillespie.
Okay. All right, Bob. Please come forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie, and I'm the administrator of the Housing Division for Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Our department worked with housing authorities to determine legislative changes that could be made to help them in their mission of providing affordable housing. This bill, House Bill 2095, is a result of that collaborative effort. I'd like to state first that the housing agency has worked a lot with housing authorities over the years. We found them to be very valuable partners in providing tax credit developments and affordable housing. In the past 10 years, through the provision of low-income housing tax credits, the housing authorities have produced in excess of 2,100 units of affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. And we do find them to be a very valuable partner to our agency for several reasons. First, I'd say they're very experienced in development. They provide a good, reliable product. They have years of experience in client verification that keeps them in compliance with the regulations that are put out by the IRS and HUD. And finally, they've been managing properties for years. They're very good asset managers, and we have a confidence in the fact that they will not only produce the units, but they'll be available through good asset management for years to come. I'd like to begin with a brief overview of House Bill 2095, and the housing authorities will later provide additional testimony in the bill. First, I'd mention quickly that the bill makes several housekeeping changes that clean up the language and bring it more current with federal programs and industry practices. There are, however, a few more significant items in the bill that I'd like to call to the attention of the committee. One item deals with how housing authorities set up partnerships. House Bill 2095 allows housing authorities to form limited liability corporations, or LLCs, as opposed to the previous practice of forming LLPs, or limited liability partnerships. When we allocate the low-income housing tax credits, we give that allocation to different organizations, and then they go into the market and actually sell that stream of credits to equity investors over a period of 10 years. And when they sell those credits, the equity investors, and when they provide the cash for the development, which is the largest portion of the development income sources, they then set up partnership agreements. And it had been the practice of the equity investors over the years to form LLPs when they provided that equity cash. More recently, with the advent of the LLCs, the equity investors in the market are looking to form that type of organization as opposed to what was previously the LLPs. So we think that it's a good business decision to allow housing authorities to form LLCs. It will keep them competitive in the market of in selling their low-income housing tax credits when we do allocate to them. A second important provision of the bill allows housing authorities to own mixed-income developments. Mixed-income developments that have residents of all incomes, including lower incomes, moderate, and average incomes. I do believe there are several advantages to mixed-income developments. The first would be financial. When you actually have the higher-income units, they provide a revenue stream that allows you to provide more affordable housing units. The second thing is it creates more of a stable type of development when you have a mixture of incomes rather than having a development that is looked at as exclusively as lower-income housing. You have a development that has a mixture of incomes, and it looks as though it's just a housing development that has some low-income housing in it and not just exclusively low-income housing. And then the third advantage to having mixed income developments is that housing authorities would be able to access resources that they currently don't really have the advantage of accessing. That's particularly the tax-exempt bond financing and the associated tax credits that go with that. These type of developments generally require, because of the financial structure, that there be some units at a higher income level or that we'd have mixed income developments. And these resources are not nearly as scarce as the other resources that housing authorities have to compete for. So by having the opportunity to create mixed income developments, they would actually have more opportunities to provide affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. And we believe that to be a good business practice as well, to allow them to have mixed income developments. The final aspect of the bill I'd like to highlight deals with the auditing practices for housing authorities. Currently, housing authorities have to produce both an annual report and an audited financial statement. We find that the audited financial statements are much more valuable. They tell us the financial strength of the organization and how they're performing over time, as well as how well they're managing their assets. And the practice of allowing them to focus their attention just on the financial audits would allow them to have a better practice, business practice, where we can see how well they're performing, both financially and with the assets that they have. So in summary, I believe that House Bill 2095 will help housing authorities by allowing them to work through LLC organizations and to own mixed income developments. The bill would also hold housing authorities accountable through required audits of their developments. And we see all these areas as positive steps in bringing housing authorities to the ability to provide affordable housing that's still needed across the state. There are amendments that are being drafted. One in particular allows housing authorities to maintain the practice of receiving property tax exemption for housing authority-owned properties. And this would be particularly to make the property tax exemption language consistent with including LLCs in that provision. There are no fiscal impacts with this associated bill or the proposed amendments. We're happy to have been able to work with the housing authorities and urge your support of House Bill 2095. And this does conclude my overview of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Bob. Questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been reviewing the bill. I noticed that on the second page, lines 16 through 21, there's a change in the definition of a person of lower income or family of lower income. And the old definition, as I read it here, requires that their income be such that housing costs would only account for 25% of the gross income. The new definition requires that income is not greater than 80% of the area median income adjusted for family size and so forth. What effect does that change have on the number of people who are eligible for that definition?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, I believe that what it allows is that there would actually be more households that would be eligible for the benefit, but I think it's particularly beneficial to the mixed income development. You have persons of up to 80% of median income who will qualify for the mixed income development. And perhaps the housing authorities might have a different answer to that.
Now you're raising a different question, if I may.
Yes, please.
And maybe I should ask someone else to answer this. But what I understood you to say earlier was that a mixed income development would allow for people who are not eligible to who don't qualify as persons of lower income to live in a portion of a larger development which was considered to be mixed income. Did I misunderstand that?
That is what I said. Would anybody want to help me with this question?
And maybe they're coming up later anyway. Yes. We can ask them at the time.
For the record, we have folks in the audience who have volunteered that they perhaps have an answer to Representative Barnhart's question. Good morning. If you would welcome, thank you for volunteering to assist with the committee's questions. If you would please introduce yourselves to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Donovan, Government Affairs Manager for the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities.
Good morning, Chair Witt. My name is James Hackett. I'm the Executive Director of the Lynn Benton Housing Authority in Albany, Oregon. And in answer to Representative Barnhart's question, the way the statute's currently written, it says affordable housing, folks who can afford at 25% of their income. There's no... doesn't speak to whether the person's low income or not. It talks about affordable housing. So someone who makes $1 million, if they can pay $250,000, it's considered affordable housing. This definition speaks more to low income, and it's in line with federal definitions of what a low income person is. It's based on area median incomes.
So if I could follow up. So what this actually does is reduce the number of people who fit under the definition, but perhaps gives us a definition which more accurately describes the people that who are our real targets.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative,
if I could follow up,
yes, follow up
with the second half of the question, which was generated really by the first answer. Do you have a response to my question about mixed income?
I have to repeat the question.
Well, the issue as it developed in the answer to the first question was, what does that mean? And what I understood from the original testimony was that it meant that people who don't qualify as persons of lower income might live in a mixed income development but pay a market rent. If that's right, then I think I understand what mixed income is. Otherwise, I don't understand it.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
Is there a blending formula, a blending ratio, so many moderate, and what is that about?
Typically, a project has to make an election to serve either 40%, a minimum of 40% of the occupants at an income of 60% of median income or below, or 20% at 50 and below. Those are some elections you have to make under bonding and tax credit rules.
Chair Witt, Representative Dalm, I would direct your attention to page 6 of the bill, line 2 through line 7. There you can see that what mixed income means is that you're going to be required to provide a deeper subsidy to affect the lower incomes, because under an existing affordable housing development, maybe you develop it and a lot of incomes are 80% of median income. What this legislation will require is that you go deeper, and that what you're using the dollars from the market rent is to provide that deeper subsidy so that you can get at lower income households.
Thank you very much.
Representative Polby.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I got a question about the audit, the annual audit. This bill replaces the Housing Authority report with a requirement for an annual audit, and I don't see that requirement. I was wondering if you could point it out to me in this bill for the annual audit.
Chair Witt, Representative Holby, on the bill, it's Section 2, line 7 on page 1. So that's the new provision, and it replaces ORS 456-170.
Just right from page, yeah. So I sort of understand where you're going with that, but the reports and recommendations that are currently required seem to have a slightly different purpose than the audit. I'm just wondering if that purpose is still going to be achieved by this audit.
Chair Witt.
The purpose in an old statute that you're appealing?
I believe it will. Generally, what happens now is that a representative from the Housing Authority will go to a meeting of the county commissioners or the city council, the body that appoints the controlling board for the Housing Authority, and makes an oral report and gives them a copy of the audit at that time. So it's something that we're doing at this point. This proposal formalizes our actual practice.
Follow up?
Please, follow up.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is in the old statute under this, that the report also involved a piece of making recommendations or other actions it deems necessary in order to carry out the purposes of the Housing Authority law. And I guess that piece I don't see in there. And I'm sure your agency can make recommendations, but it seems like it was an important part of the old statute was, you know, to really be making recommendations to the governing bodies about how to better carry out the Housing Authority law. And so, I mean, it just disturbs me that an audit doesn't necessarily do that. And so I guess that piece of it is, you know, and I'm sure your agencies are, you know, that's part of what internal to what you're always thinking about is how we can better provide low-income housing, but specifically making that report from your agency to the governing body, I think is sort of important in my mind that you really give a report about, you know, what you think ought to happen in relationship to providing low-income housing, and so I'm just worried that that piece disappears and is replaced by an audit full of numbers that doesn't have any recommendations at the end of it. That's my only concern.
Chair Witt and Representative Holby, if I can speak to the audit first. Audits now have a management analysis and discussion section that would kind of go into what governmental factors could improve the provision of affordable housing. Beyond that, the original legislation also dealt with areas where there is a housing authority that deals statewide. Now, in Oregon, we have 22 housing authorities divided up by counties and cities, but there are some states, such as Idaho and Alaska, that have statewide housing authorities. And if you look at 456-170, the original provision, it talks about going to make a report about changes that can be made to the legislation and the housing authority's law. Well, the housing authority law is a state statute, and so our local board of county commissioners or city council can't make a change to that. We're here before you to talk about that change. So I don't know that we can make proposals to our local board about changes to legislation and be effective.
Okay, Representative Holy. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'd just like to commend you for this bill. I actually I think it's a pretty darn good bill. I realize that probably in the last 15 years there's been a trend to move to more mixed development, and the way I see this is a way to conform to that trend and to kind of move into that niche. And I think it's far better to have developments like this than probably just large low-income housing developments to fit into this. So, but the question I had is somebody mentioned something about amendments or that, and I was kind of curious as to what you think needs to be amended in here.
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, if I could kind of dive into my testimony, I can answer that question and also kind of give you all a little bit of a background of how James and I and some members of the audience come to being here.
Please, Phil.
If you would.
Please.
Well, great. Well, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm, as I said, government affairs representative for the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. We are a statewide association that provides affordable housing opportunities for over 45,000 Oregonians, 45,000 households. throughout the state. And we are well known because we manage a lot of public housing. We also transfer a lot of federal funds into local communities through the Section 8 Housing Voucher Program. But as you know, increasingly this is changing as federal funding support is declined. And what that's required is that housing authorities be more innovative. And some of the people that you're going to hear from today are help leading that charge. During the legislative interim, we received a Best Housing Practices Act that James can speak to. But essentially, what it made us ask the question of, has anybody done a line-by-line review of our statutes? I hadn't done it since I had begun working with housing authorities since 2001. And when we had the conversation, what we found is that it hadn't been done in quite some time. And so three housing authority directors, including James, volunteered their time to do a thorough line-by-line examination of all of the statutes that pertain to the housing authorities. Bob Gillespie at the state of Oregon, he's already done a very thorough covering of what's in the bill, and I don't want to replow that turf, but I do want to take a moment just to thank Oregon Housing and Community Services. They were very good partners in helping us review this and ask some of the difficult questions, some of which you're talking about today. So instead of kind of going over the guts of the bill, what I want to do is I want to quickly just jump to the fact is once you get a bill printed and out in circulation, other ideas begin to percolate up, and we identified some additional areas of what I would call improvements. And so a brief summary of the amendments. Now, we don't have amendments from Legislative Council to share with you yet, so I'm just going to describe them, and then I think at a future date, once we have amendments back from Legislative Council, we can come back and have a formal hearing and hopefully a work session at that time. But a quick summary, there's four changes. First, in the original draft, and you can actually see this change, on page 2, line 22, there's the omission of the definition of a person of very low income. Frankly, we administer some federal housing and urban development, HUD, programs where we are required to serve persons of very low income, and it would be beneficial to leave that statute alone. So basically we just want to keep that in, and right now under the current version that would be omitted. Second, we have been running into an issue of private companies procuring the name Housing Authority and then using the Housing Authority name to go and sell different items. Now, nobody can go and grab Oregon Housing and Community Services name and then begin to sell items because they're incorporated with the state. Well, our incorporation is with counties and cities and therefore not with the state, and so we need legislation to be able to protect the name Housing Authority so that it's not used for something beyond the means of what we're trying to accomplish. Third, we realized that in allowing housing authorities to establish nonprofits or limited liability companies, that we also needed to amend the state tax code to reflect the same. The language that you see on page 6, line 9, which says to form, finance, have a non-stock interest in, operate partnerships, nonprofit corporations, and limited liability companies, well, that language exists in ORS 307092. But it doesn't say limited liability companies, and therefore if we were to form a liability company, it would raise the question of whether the property tax exemption, which we use to keep housing units affordable, would follow under the new construction. So we want to clarify that in the revenue code. And then finally, given the recent closures of manufactured home parks and the loss of affordability that they represent, we want to add manufactured home parks to the list of dwellings that we're lawfully allowed to operate. We've been approached from time to time about our involvement being a partner in helping maintain manufactured home parks, and this kind of change would just codify that we would be allowed to adopt that practice. So anyways, the chairman has provided us a note to go to Legislative Council, get these amendments drafted up, but I wanted to put them on the table today. And so, Representative Gerard, those are the four improvements that we'd like to bring.
Sounds here. Pretty in-depth. Sounds good.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I think that's right. It has been in-depth. I mean, we took the legislative interim to kind of carefully consider this. And actually, James, not only is he a housing authority director, he's an attorney at law, as I like to point out. And so he was a great help in kind of working through the language that you see before you.
Yeah, thank you.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Chair Witt. The questions concerning the page 2, line 16, concerning the definition of the 80% of area median income, and then if there is $1 million house in that area, and if you go in there to develop this mixed housings, then that up to the 80% of that median income could be $500,000 and more, then the $400,000 is that the 80% of that, if it's the $500,000 income area, that's considered the person of eligible income means, person of lower income or a family of lower income means a person or a family residing in the state. That means that even though they are making $400,000, are considered as a lower income family. How do you translate that?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, you're right. Your analysis is correct. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, federal Department of HUD, creates median income numbers for all communities across the United States. And there are no communities in Oregon where the median income is $500,000. But there are some communities in the United States where median incomes are quite high, San Francisco, San Diego. And if, for instance, a median income there of a family of four is $100,000, that's the median, there's as many making more as there are making less than $100,000, then $80,000 would be considered low income. And rightly so, because in those markets, it's very expensive to find housing. And some people need assistance finding affordable housing, even though to you and I, that sounds like an awful lot of money. So the 80% threshold is also a federal threshold for defining low income. Housing authorities typically are serving folks at 30% of median income and below. We are serving extremely low-income people. And part of the proposal here is to have this mixed income so that we can serve people at 80, maybe a little bit more, a moderate average income, to be able to have an internal subsidy in a project to deeply skew other rents for folks who have much lower income.
Please, follow up.
I'm somewhat puzzled of this proposal, especially the try to mix up the development. And some people wants to live in certain area, and then with this bill could be mixed up a lot of people together. And then this is the concern. And if it's the market driven, it's fine. But the state government with this bill, asking the housing authority or HUD and go over there develop, it could be some problems in that area. I'm not trying to discriminate anyone or any business, but this is not the market driven and the HUD driven and try to mix up. I have some concerns in that area, and especially if it could be managed by the under the non-profit corporation, then it's an additional problem with it because of the tax issue. I think that issue should be clarified. I hope I gave you the clear questions.
Well, Representative Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I think the question that you're asking is a concern around concentration of low-income families. And the idea behind this legislation is to deconcentrate the number of low-income families in any given area, because we found that there's a positive societal benefit to mixing people of different incomes. Clearly, on the units or the projects where a mixed income, the people who choose to rent the market rate rentals, they're going to make that choice themselves to want to live in those kinds of circumstances. And we have some great examples of that that will be coming. Cindy Cook, who is from the Central Oregon Housing Authority called Housing Works, she has some examples from Vancouver, Washington, where they have the ability to do mixed income projects in Washington State, and Vancouver has some very innovative ideas that have brought together a range of incomes under literally one roof.
Phil, that ability that you're talking about presumably then means that this bill is permissible and not mandatory?
Chair Witt, absolutely.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up question.
Please, Representative Lim.
Have you discussed this issue with the developers and home builders and plus many other entities in our state?
Representative Witt, or Chair Witt, Representative Lim, we have been in conversations with basically the range of affordable housing interests, and we've done so through the coalition that's called the Housing Alliance. We've also made inquiries of the counties and cities, and also just had hallway conversations with others in the development industry. And in fact, Cindy Cook from Housing Works will bring examples of some Oregon developers who participated in developing mixed income and the enthusiasm that they would bring to this.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
As we progress this bill, I'd like to hear from them directly on this committee, what they thought about this proposal.
Okay. Thank you. And if you could be mindful of that, please, Phil. And Representative Dahlem, I'm going to ask you to hold for just a minute and to recognize Representative Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. What I wanted to just bring to the attention of the committee that in Hillsboro, when we built our new Civic Center, there was a requirement of the developer to also build some housing units as basically a part of that project. They were actually separate projects, but they were both required. And the city required the developer to mix those units and have some of them at market rate and some of them at lower than market rate for affordability. And that unit, that development has been extremely successful. It's in a place where people want to be, and it has really worked well. And I'd invite you to come out, and if you would like to come out to Hillsboro and see that and see what's happened there.
Thank you.
Thank you for that offer, Vice Chair Riley. Representative Dahlem.
I think most of my questions have been answered, Chair Witt. I would just make a couple of statements that. One, it appears as though we're trying to break up the concentration of affordable housing and move that population into the general population. We could say it that way, or we could say that we are blending our neighborhoods. But we're only blending those neighborhoods that choose to be blended. And if we were forcing neighborhoods to blend, then I would share your concerns, John. But it appears to me that this is voluntary. If you want to participate in the advantages, tax advantages of the housing authority, then you must provide this kind of housing. So it is voluntary. I want to avoid the notion of saying exclusive neighborhoods, but those are still available. If you want to live in a gated community, you can still do that. I guess if you want to build a gated community with housing authority support, you better have some blended housing.
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem, I appreciate your comments. I want to emphasize this legislation is intended to be permissive. But at the same time, it has some requirements in it, but the requirements are on the housing authorities to make sure that they're serving low-income Oregonians.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, there's one point that hasn't been made yet directly on this issue. And please help me with this if I get it wrong, because I'm not an expert in this area. But I know that that the development of low-income housing has gone through a number of iterations over the last 50, 75, or 100 years. The early plans that led to very large construction in some cities that were strictly segregated on the basis of income have failed. In fact, the buildings deteriorated, it became difficult places for people to live, and for a whole variety of reasons and so forth. And as I understand it, the idea of mixed housing is because when you mix people with different incomes, different backgrounds, different ways of making a living, that you end up with a facility that you can maintain, that you are able to provide a safe place for families to live and grow, and that's the reason, at least as much as any of the other things you've mentioned, for working on a mixed development rather than a completely segregated development. The segregated development simply doesn't work as well for families. Have I got that right?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, you have gotten that right, and I'm going to add one more to the list. You also end up with a higher quality project. If you have the expectation that you're going to attract market rents, you have to have an attractive development that people are going to choose, you know, over other rental opportunities.
Thank you. Phil, I had a couple of questions here. One is a follow-up, I think, to the question that Representative Gollum made. And I need to have you take me back to where we are pre this bill and what the thinking was around this. And I was just surprised that we were asking, in essence, for permission to be able to have mixed income housing. Do we need to have, in essence, legislative permission to do that? And
Representative Webb. Absolutely. We want to follow the law as closely to the T as possible. But what you will find in this legislation is that some areas, the issue was they were silent to. For example, we could form a partnership under current statute, but now we have a better vehicle, limited liability companies, and we also know that some housing authorities are forming nonprofits to be able to provide residential services within developments. Again, the law was silent to that. Well, in doing a review of the legislation, we identified areas where we can clarify and codify what we think are the best practices.
Okay, fine, thank you. And then on page 3 of the bill, some of your new language here. In line 15, the bill addresses the demolition of slum areas.
Yeah. Chair Witt, that's actually just a reordering by Legislative Council. That's not new language. You'll see that this is this current language is found on page 2, line 44, and it's been moved from that section to it's just been reordered, actually.
I see where it goes. Yeah. And is the term slum area defined someplace? And the reason I ask that question, I think I potentially have the definition.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's on line 29 on page 2.
Okay. All right, fine. My concern there was that we have some sidebars. I was very concerned about past history where we've had social, economic, and cultural dislocation, I think particularly in the 60s. It's not isolated to that decade. And I certainly want to make sure that we had adequate means to avoid that kind of dislocation.
Yeah. Representative Witt, it is something of a if I may be so bold to say, something of a loaded term with lots of connotations to it. But as you can see, the term is defined in statute, current statute.
Yes, Representative,
Mr. Chair, of course, it is a constitutional issue. It comes out of some Supreme Court cases having to do with eminent domain and public purpose.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I am going to recess our hearing in honor of the funeral of PFC Ryan Cervica, and we will come back into session following that funeral procession. Time uncertain, and I would just, out of respect for that procession, however long it takes, and as soon as it's over, if we would please come back to the room. Thank you, gentlemen, and if there are any further questions or comments, we'll catch you when we come back. We're in recess.
Okay.
Chair Witt and members of the committee. It's great to be here. And I want to say that you've got some Central Oregon sunshine over here. It was great this morning to wake up to some good sunshine. So, good for you. Thank you for taking the time. I know that you all have very busy jobs, but I want to talk about something that is really important.
Cindy, if I could interrupt just for a moment, would you please, for the record, introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Cindy Cook, and I'm the Executive Director for Housing Works, which is the assumed business name for the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority, and we serve three counties, Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crick.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, housing authorities across the nation have been really challenged, I think, by the diminishing federal commitment. And as it was mentioned earlier today, there has been many changes in federal housing programs. But today, I think most importantly, those shifts have been made to where the state, and particularly the state of Oregon, is now playing a much greater role in trying to house a lower income citizenship. So our job as housing authorities have been to really step up to the plate and become a lot more creative. I think this bill certainly helps us get there. I have worked for my organization for the past 25 years. We currently manage eight partnerships where we have created essentially workforce housing. Is if we think about the tax credit program, and it serves 50 to 60% of area median income, that is really heart and center into the retail and service industry. We're a lifestyle community, not unlike other communities in Oregon, and we have a lot of folks who are serving coffee, cleaning tables, working in the banks, actually now the entry-level police force, entry-level teachers, they are all very challenged to find an affordable place to live. I had the opportunity to spend some time up in Washington State. And some of the development partners I have done some fabulous work up in Washington. And I wanted to highlight two particular projects that have been done in the Vancouver area. The Vancouver Housing Authority has been able to partner with a variety of different developers to really create mixed income neighborhoods. And I think most importantly, it's been an economic development boon for the communities that they have served. For example, Esther Short Commons. I don't know how many of you have seen the downtown Vancouver redevelopment, but Esther Short Commons was a critical piece of that downtown redevelopment. When I first arrived in Oregon back in 1980 from Alaska, I went into the Vancouver environment, in the downtown environment, because I happened to like antique stores, and sometimes you'll find those in downtown hearts. It wasn't safe to be there. And today, because of the economic revitalization and the introduction of mixed income housing, it is a thriving, beautiful, trendy place to be. Now, I took some of my board members over there to really give them a view of what's been happening in the urban markets. And I have, did we get those out? I was able to talk to one of the senior citizens who lived in Esther Short Commons. And we were visiting in the marketplace, and she welcomed us up to her apartment after we gave her considerable assurance that we weren't out to rob her or hurt her in any way. But this woman was an extremely low-income person served by the Housing Authority in a mixed-income development, and she had a view of the river that was incredible. She was very proud of her apartment, and she could afford to be there. It was heartwarming, absolutely heartwarming. So my dream is that in Oregon, we do have real practices, best practices, where our communities are seamless, where low-income people are served well in a mix of different social and economic types. And I'm really honored to be a part of that. and I hope to retire in the next 6 or 7 years. And by the time I retire, I hope that we've got some fabulous, fabulous mixed income communities in our very fast growing region in the state, which, as you know, is extremely expensive. We just completed a workforce housing needs assessment where in 2008, the prediction is we will have a need for over 8,000 workforce housing units. Out of those 8,000, there is approximately 3,500 that will be needed just at the 60% and below of area median income. Our tasks are monumental. Our federal partners have diminished their commitment. So I think today we've got an opportunity to make a big difference by combining resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional members of the panel?
Thank you, Chair Witt. Pardon me. My name is Mike Andrews, and I'm the Director for Development and Community Revitalization with the Housing Authority of Portland. Housing Authority of Portland serves all of Multnomah County. We own about 6,000 units of housing. 4,000 of those are units that have been financed with tax credits, tax-exempt debt, and other more conventional affordable housing resources. The balance are more traditional public housing. I'm here today to speak specifically to a couple of elements of the House Bill 2095 and to provide some context to elaborate on some of the conversation from earlier this morning. The Housing Authority of Portland is just has just completed the development of a project that we call New Columbia. This is an 80-acre development in the city of Portland that's a mixed-income project. We served as the master developer of this project, and we developed 556 rental units that are in this community. In addition to the 556 rental units that we financed using the low-income housing tax credit, which required the use of a limited partnership, and I'll speak to the LLC in a moment, we also invited home builders onto the project. There were 232 for-sale homes that exist on this 80 acres with our 556 units of rental housing. It is very much a mixed-income project. There are folks that are very low-income that live there, and there are folks that have bought a house for $290,000. The point that was made earlier about the quality of the product very much rang true with our development, that we sold those lots to home builders who took a risk, who paid real money, upwards of $35,000 a lot from us to buy these lots. They then sold these homes on to the open market. They needed assurances that what we were building was going to be a quality product, well-maintained, so that folks would spend their hard-earned money on a home in our project. And in October of 2006, we finished building our project. The home builders will finish building all of their homes by March of this year. All of them have been sold. They have very much met or exceeded expectations. So I make that point to reinforce the notion of the importance of a mixed-income project. The rental units that we built at New Columbia, as well as many other rental units that the Housing Authority of Portland owns, were financed with the low-income housing tax credit, which Bob Gillespie mentioned this morning. All of those units are currently owned by limited partnerships that the Housing Authority is the sole general partner of. And that is a function of the way in which the federal tax credit works and within the limits of the existing state law that allows for the use of limited partnerships. The ability to create LLCs is advantageous for housing authorities because as we're in this environment of looking to use different financial tools, the LLC creates an opportunity to limit our risk as a real estate developer, as a real estate owner, by limiting our financial exposure to what we've invested in that LLC. A fundamental difference between limited partnerships and limited liability corporations is that your exposure is basically limited to what you've invested. For the projects that we own through a limited partnership, we're the general partner, and not only are we at risk for that partnership, but all of our assets are basically on the hook. In an LLC structure, you limit your exposure to what you've invested in that particular transaction. So it's very advantageous to us as developers of real estate who are trying to be more creative and use more of the tools available to us to have the access to an LLC, which is now available under federal law, as we go about using more and more of these financial tools that have become available. I'll stop there and be available to answer any questions if there are any.
I think what I'm going to do, because we may be losing a couple of our committee members here a little early today, is hold questions from the committee until the panel's completed. So, Paul?
Great. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Paul Rainey. I'm serving in the role of association management for the Oregon Housing Authorities. And I just wanted to take a second real quickly to thank you for the questions we've had today. I thought we've had a very thoughtful discussion. I appreciate your interest in this issue. And I'm here on the panel to help answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Now questions from the committee. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm trying to get my brain back into this after a somber event. I really support this concept. I think it's a great concept. I think it's just great for community as such. But I got a question about the structure of the LLC. And what that provides, because I believe under statute now, I'm wondering about the partners in this LLC, and the Housing Authority is sort of tasked under statute to provide this housing and really not make a profit, and traditionally they've been nonprofits. So is there a potential for partners in this LLC structure to participate in this and to have a certain amount of profit out of this structure, and would there be a limit to that kind of profit?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Holby. So when any developer uses a low-income housing tax credit, that credit is a benefit that you're selling to your investor partner. So using the limited partner structure, for example, in our instance, we are the sole general partner, and we go about bringing causing the development of the project. And we receive this credit benefit from Oregon Housing and Community Services, and we sell that benefit to our limited partner. The reason we sell that benefit is to get their cash equity to build the project. They then receive a federal reduction in their tax liability in return for investing in an affordable housing project. That is it's very much a commodity in today's housing market, and we sell that credit. There's a lot of investors that are looking to buy that credit. It's still very much a developer's market, so developers are able to secure a significant amount of money from these investors. Every transaction that is done is required to have an opinion written by our counsel that says what we're doing is consistent with all applicable law, with state law and with federal law. So every transaction has a level of review on it to make sure that appropriate regulations and statutes are adhered to. The equity or the return that is provided to our investor is very much a market rate transaction. So we're looking to secure the most money that we can and sell that credit for as much as we can. And we have competition. We have investors compete against one another, so we know that we're getting as much money for that credit as we can, and have them compete on terms as well. So price is definitely a consideration, but also the level of guarantees that they require and when they're going to give us their money and things like that. So there's a market element that exists in the low-income housing tax credit business that assures the developer on our side that we're getting the best terms and conditions possible.
Further questions?
Yes, I sort of got that, I'm still a little bit fuzzy, and I understand the credit part and selling that credit, but I know right now that the Housing Authority isn't supposed to construct or operate the housing for profit or as a source of revenue for the city or a county. Mm-hmm. And so, but what I'm hearing you say as well is that some of the partners that have bought these credits and invested this money, in addition to that, will be able to have a profit at a market rate, I guess. I guess I'm wondering what that market rate is. It able to change Are there any limits to that market rate? I guess that's my question.
There are no limits imposed. It's similar to borrowing money from a bank. So we pay an interest rate if we borrow money. Mm-hmm. The bank gets their interest rate return. Right now, market rate for tax credit equity is around 5 to 8%. The equity is actually cheaper money right now than debt. So it's very much in line with borrowing money and using debt to build a project.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Chair Witt. You mentioned concerning the diminishing federal government dollars. And can you elaborate a little bit more? Could you understand what I'm saying?
The federal dollar is going away.
Yes. Diminishing, did I pronounce correctly?
Diminishing,
correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Witt, Representative Lim. In the past 20 years, we have seen a marked decline in dollars available for construction of what was considered public housing. As it was commented earlier, many of those public housing developments did fall into urban decay and were imploded. There hasn't been a significant program to replace those federal dollars for new construction, other than the tax credit program. The tax credit program is an IRS program under Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Service Code, and it truly marries the partnership between the private sector investors, who are today institutional investors, they tend to be banks, and the return for those banks is that they get Community Reinvestment Act credit as well as a modest return on their investment when they're purchasing the tax credits. So we have had a significant decline in federal policy. And I'll put it on a very real level. In our area, we only have 48 units of public housing. Those funds were granted in 1979. The units were built in 1984, and we are being forced to sell them as the operating subsidy has been diminished. We can no longer afford to keep those. Every housing authority in the nation is faced with a similar problem. We knew that we couldn't seek public housing funds with any deal of success over the 24 years that I've been in this business, and we instead went to our toolbox, which was our bonding authority, as well as low-income housing tax credits, and our partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services, we have over 600 units that we have developed through Oregon Housing and Community Services. Does that answer your question,
Representative? Thank you very much.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. My first question is, would you tell us again where the Portland project that you were describing a minute ago is located?
Absolutely. Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart. It is in North Portland in the Portsmouth neighborhood, up on the peninsula. It's about due north of the University of Portland, between Columbia Boulevard and Lombard are the sort of major arterials that flank the project.
Okay. And if I may, just an additional, this may evolve into a question, but the explanation we just heard about the structure of the financial structure of these kinds of projects is a very familiar one, and it's generally used to finance projects. I'm aware of several projects in the Eugene area that are financed, the details being different, but in essentially the same way. It to the uninitiated, including me most of the time, it sounds very complex, very difficult, and it requires a high level of expertise in order to make the thing actually work, pencil out, so that you can pay the bills, provide the rent subsidy, and have a comfortable place for people to live when you're all finished, and then manage the project over the long haul. This is not something for the faint of heart, is it?
Representative Witt, Representative Barnhart, having been the first tax credit developer east of the Cascades, it has been definitely a labor of love. and a lesson that I'm not, the learning curve, I'm not sure where else I would have gotten this experience. But I'm here today to say that we have fabulous units, and they are all very well maintained and in very good condition, and our investors' report card is excellent. So, but it's a competitive market. It's competitive to even get the credit. So when you enter into Oregon Housing and Community Services with a project, it is so competitive that we anticipate that we'll have to go in one, two, and maybe three times before we'll actually get funded, which means that we have to find investors who will assist us in holding land so that we can go through the next few years to actually secure those credits. Once we get the credits, however, the competition is very fun, particularly in our area, and I'm sure in Portland as well. We're in hot markets, and investors all over the United States are quite interested.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlman, before we proceed, witnesses, sometimes you have to kind of find that optimum distance from the mic when you're speaking, so just a little more distance might be helpful. Representative Dahlem.
Yes, I picked up, I want to be sure I understand it. Because of the subsidies and the shrinking federal participation, some housing authorities are being forced to liquidate their assets. I'm assuming then that a private investor comes in, takes over, and the subsidy is gone. What happens to the rent in that case, and what happens to the people that are paying the rent?
Representative Witt, Representative Dong, this is probably, you've hit on something that's somewhat emotional for me. The deep subsidy programs where residents paid 30% of their income towards rent, and it was based on their income, is virtually disappearing. The tax credit program will not replace that. That deep subsidy in our area is $6 million in rental assistance to extremely low-income people over a one-year period. So over half of the people that we serve are disabled and elderly. The federal government has given us some assurance that rental subsidy through the voucher program will remain intact. But new construction with deep subsidy is going to be very difficult to get. It's going to be eked out over the country, and it's probably going to be focused more in the Gulf region as that has become an emerging priority.
Thank you.
Chairwoman, Representative Dahlem, two questions that were asked. This year, housing authorities are faced with what HUD calls a proration. Mm-hmm. So when you own public housing, there's a contract with HUD that says, we will give you this much money to run your housing. And there's an agreed-upon amount of money that they will provide. HUD seldom provides you the full amount that the contract says you will get. This year, HUD is telling housing authorities that they will get 76% of what is contractually obligated to the housing authorities. So 75 cents on the dollar is what is being provided to housing authorities, which is why housing authorities are faced with the reality of being not able to run the real estate. And they're looking to sell that real estate because it just can't work with three quarters of what it takes to run it. So it's, you know, this is sort of the reality for housing authorities, where you have the federal subsidies like public housing that are diminishing, and what is there to replace it are things like tax credits, which is not a HUD program. It's an IRS program. So the federal government's longest standing housing program is in IRS, and HUD has nothing to do with the tax credit program. So housing authorities are having to face things like understanding limited partnerships and limited liability corporations and how tax rules govern what we do. So it's the days of the cash funded programs are no longer there. Now the good side of that is that it provides a level of involvement that didn't exist before. So you have investors, and you have many folks who are making sure that your projects perform. So our investors spend a lot of time with us. Each of our limited partnerships are audited every year. They send people out to take a look at the real estate, make sure it's operating well. So I think one of the reasons I think that the tax credit program has existed since 1986 is that there's a lot of eyes looking at it. There's a lot of people who have a stake in it, and it runs rather well. It's complicated. It's not for the faint of heart, but there's a lot of folks that pay attention to it, and I think that its longevity is a function of the American Bankers Association focusing on this tax credit program and wanting to make sure that it's not toyed with.
Further questions or comments? Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Representative Dahlem's question, however, it's my guess that when the housing authority sells these units, when they have to sell them, there's no choice, one of two things happens. Either the rent goes up so much that the current residents are not able to stay there, or they're turned out and the place is demolished or turned into some other kind of business. Is that correct?
Representative Riley, I'm sorry I wasn't very clear on the answer to that question. In our area, some of our units are single-family. We will be offering them for first-time home ownership to lower-income residents, and preferably those who are currently residents in those units. We have retained a portion of our vouchers so that we'll be giving them what few federal vouchers we have, and we will be assisting them in finding replacement housing. And some of that housing may be in our tax credit properties. I think this really highlights the reason why mixed income is so important to us today, that we've got the ability to develop communities and take that revenue stream and really help the most vulnerable of our citizens, because the federal government is not going to do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Panel, thank you very, very much for your excellent testimony. And Cindy, thank you for giving us the flavor of both what's needed and perhaps a pathway to get there. I appreciate your testimony very much, and appreciate the fact that you had to travel some considerable distance to bring us your testimony. So thank you very much.
And thank you all for spending the time on this most crucial piece of legislation for us.
And you're way too young to retire. Please don't retire very soon.
Thank you.
She lives closer to my district than yours, Representative Riley.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 2095? Not seeing anyone at this point. Ellen, would you please give us a preview of Monday's hearing, please?
Thank you, Chair Witt. On February 5th, beginning at 8 a.m., the committee will be having an informational meeting on workforce development in the construction industry. We'll be hearing from the Oregon State Building Trades Council, the Northwest College of Construction, the Oregon Building Congress, Oregon Tradeswomen, and Sabin-Schellenberg Center, which is a community college type development.
Thank you. Anything further from the committee? Not seeing anything. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Chairman, when will you bring